I should have said the poet. I should have said the poet. The poet.
Sending poets. This is Sending Poets, a podcast about ideas. Our goal is to understand metaphorical truths within the beauty we find in the human experience. My name is John. With me is Bob and Tucker. What's up, fellas?
Hey, what's
up? How you guys doing?
And we're starting some three-body problem convos. So this time, we're going to try to focus more on the problems with the intent of setting up next week's episode, which will be the solutions. So should be fun. So seems like begin at the beginning, right? So I thought, let's just talk about what is the actual three-body problem. It is an actual thing. It's not just a made-up thing, you know, book title, show title. It's an actual physics problem. Do one of you guys want to dive into that first?
I'll talk a little bit about it. Sweet. Basically, the idea is that when you have more than two large astronomical bodies, you cannot calculate a long-term orbit unless you know the original starting position. And because it's basically impossible to go that far back in time and say, well, this is the original position of these three suns, you can't ever determine a long-term stable orbit. You're always going to be missing that piece of the equation that is necessary to determine the long-term orbits.
And it's kind of, because it's unknowable, unsolvable, I don't know the right term there, but it's just sort of, there's always going to be chaos, right?
There's always going to be chaos, and you can't determine if there will ever be a stable orbit because you're missing the first part of the equation, which is what was the original starting point. And I have not dived in it deep enough to know. To me, I don't think you could even determine the original starting point of a two-body system, because things don't just pop into existence. You know, it's accretion, it's things slowly building into what we call a sun or a planet. They don't just appear. It's something that happens over time.
Yeah. Can I share this real quick? Because one of the things that occurred to me when I first started watching the show, and I didn't know about what the actual three-body problem was, so I think it's in the third episode where the character actually uses the phrase. It's a classic three-body problem, I think, is the line. And I was thinking about it, and my brain kind of came up with this idea. It's that I think there's a lot of similarity in raising a human being. And so, like, just in the simple sense of three-body, like, two parents and a child, let's just call it that, two parents and a child. And in the same way, I love how you said, like, unless you know the very starting point. And so one person, you know, you might think, well, yeah, the parents were there when the baby was born, right? The starting point. But I think this goes back to the genetic thing we've talked about. And are we passing genetic memories and stuff? And like, that's why I think it's similar, because none of us really know our true ancestral heritage. Like, the truth, right? The truth is like that third part of the story, mine, yours, and the truth. And the truth is a victim to time, man. And like, where did we start from? Like, nobody knows that at this point. Nobody can go back and be like, this is where exactly where I came from. By the way, just a real quick tangent into Dune Part Two. Frank Herbert just describes that by drinking the water of life, you have all these ancestral memories come back to you. So it's kind of an interesting take there. So just wanted to share that because I thought that was interesting. Like, yeah, it is kind of impossible to raise a human, you know, not impossible, but the chaos that it's, there's just this potential that no matter what there's going to be unknown stuff. There's only so much you can try to predict, because much in the same way you can't predict the orbit if it's a three body system. So I think there's a parallel there. Maybe it's a stretch. I like to do stretches, you guys know.
But yeah. Well, I mean, think of it this way. They say, you know, if you go far enough back in time, we're all African, right?
Mm.
Well, if you go further than that, we're all sea sponges. Mm. How does that help you? It doesn't.
Right, yeah.
You know, like,
yeah. Let me, if I may, let me just tag on sure. to what Tucker put out there. I think that's right. But just a finer detail here, position and velocity or direction. So, I mean, there is something to be said about this initial state. But then on the other side of the coin is chaos. So it's a non-periodic orbit of three bodies. It's just impossible, other than with very few unreasonable examples where you can artificially create a three-body system that has periodic orbits that's stable. It's always this chaotic system that boils down to an eventual ejection of one of the three. So there is periodic motion between two massive heavenly bodies that can be calculated far into the distance, and it's just, you know, a very simple equation. But the difficulty lies when you add that third, obviously the starting point, granting Tucker's point, yes, you don't have a starting position, don't have a starting velocity. But even if you did, then the physics is so interesting because inherently it's unstable. It just cannot hold. And so as these three bodies or more, but starts with three, as these three bodies begin influencing one another, it eventually kicks one of them out of the system so that it can settle down into essentially like a lower energy state and a more periodic orbit. So it doesn't really happen in nature in that, I mean, it might sustain itself for millions of years or tens of millions of years, but once you get far enough out in time, the system is chaotic and it will essentially eject or exclude some of the bodies so that it can form then a periodic stable, two body situation.
Is that related to like entropy, how you described that there, of like is that too much of a stretch there, that like the two bodies want to kind of normalize so they'll push the third one out, or
I think of it more as like lower energy, like electrons want to be at the lower level, close, like there's a it's like things want to roll downhill. Okay, there's a natural tendency for something to be at a lower energetic position than a higher energetic position. It's just inherently more stable. So you have, let's say, just metaphorically, you have shells of electrons. The lower the level of the electron shell, the more stable it is, the system, the more coherent it is, the more attractive it is. It's harder to dislodge it. Whereas if you have many, many outer shells of electrons, these further electron shells are much easier to, with, you know, take away from the given atom or molecule. So you will have stability and a periodic nature, predictable. And I think that's the great mystery, is why is that so? Why can't, what makes it so much more difficult to have three than two and four and five and six, et cetera? That's the great mystery. And it's unexplained, obviously, but that's the great mystery, is why is that so? Why is it so much difficult when the same rule should apply? And there are some examples of periodic orbits of three bodies, but they're all extremely artificial looking. Doesn't make any sense. And they're all, you know, like going back to Tucker's point, if it's a periodic system, you don't really have to know its initial position because it's just repeating the same things over and over again. So it's when you're getting to this chaotic system, like you'd like to know the initial position and momentum, let's just say, or velocity of the given bodies, it surely would help. But at what point is the first point? Like, at what point do you begin measuring? Because it's always different. It's always evolving, always chaotic. Whereas if you have a very periodic, stable orbit, you don't really have to find the first position because they're just repeating over and over again.
Wow.
So I think it blends more to, I take your point on entropy, but it's more about chaos. So having a chaotic system would be, you know, less uniform. So there's entropy is uniformity. It's degradation of difference. So I think to your point, John, you would start a system with, you know, the classic cream and coffee analogy, where you have cream and you're mixing it into the coffee. At the beginning, the entropy is low because they're separated. Anytime you look in the coffee, you might have a probability of finding a little bit of coffee and a probability of finding a little bit of cream. At high entropy, it's all mixed together. It's uniform. And wherever you look, you're going to find equal amounts of cream and coffee throughout that cup. So, you know, there's a chaotic moment where you can never measure this thing and get a consistent result. It's always going to be in flux. It's always changing. And each one, like the theory is, you know, each one is complex, a complex interaction. So each one modifies the other one, which modifies the other one, and just round and round it goes, and it becomes extremely complex because, you know, each one is modifying the other one. There's a push and pull, and it becomes incalculable.
So but I think I have a good way to kind of visualize this, and it has to do with the very last simulation they did, you know, when the three suns were in a line and it started pulling all the people off the planet, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So when you have three suns, granted, one of them is going to be the smallest. And when you have an alignment like that, those two larger suns are going to shift the orbit of that smaller sun. The combined gravity of those two larger ones are actually going to shift the orbit of that smaller sun. Well, in order to calculate long-term orbits, you have to know, was that the first time that happened? And because you can't know that's the first time that's happened, you can't know where that smaller sun originally was.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah, let's go into the simulation theory problem. I'll try to stick with that word here. But because you mentioned that, you know, it's really a genius way to introduce the whole storyline through this headset that has, you know, the timing. Bob, I think you said this before we started recording. The timing of this is so interesting because I'm sure we said so in a podcast. I know I've talked to people about simulation theory and this idea that, like, the technology doesn't exist today, you know, for simulating reality. So when they put that headset on, and one of the first, I think it's Jack, the character Jack, you know, he grabs the dirt and not only grabs it, but he tastes it, you know, and it's very clear, like, oh, this technology is simulating all reality.
Indistinguishably.
Yeah. Super cool. I remember saying the exact words to people, you know, months ago. I can't remember when this show came out. So maybe it was a month or two ago that it came out, but way before that, you know, for me to believe we're in a simulation now, it's like, yeah, I'd have to know that technology exists, that I could put a headset on. It literally said that you could put a headset on and what I would see and feel and hear would be indistinguishable from when I didn't have the headset on. So it was really satisfying for me as a viewer to be like, this is what I was talking about, you know? So I thought that was really neat.
I agree. And it ties into the one of the solutions potential for the Fermi paradox, right? Which is, this is all simulation. So the concept being, most likely outcome is not that we're in the one original, like a statistical basis. Most likely outcome is we're not in the one original universe that the computer that houses the simulation is built in. Much more likely that the one original universe creates many, many, many computers that all have billions and billions of simulations running, and then we are in that simulation, and it's indistinguishable from what we would call reality.
Which is kind of crazy to really dive in and think about.
It's messed up.
You know?
Yeah, it's messed up. It's like you're in The Sims, you know, essentially. You're in The Sims.
Yeah.
And you're probably on some alien's, you know, laptop. And this is his homework project for high school.
Right.
<you know?
laughs> So I was going to ask you guys, what did you think about the headset itself? Because, it's convenient in the story. I think it's described as like this is a game she was playing. The Dr. Ye Jr. I think like right. Vera, the Dr. Ye Sr. was the one who gave the headset to Jin, and that was her invitation. At first I was like, cause she lied. She says later, like, she said that Vera was playing this game. Here's the headset she was using, but she's admitted that was a lie.
Yeah.
Because that was the whole thing, is you had to be invited to play, which I thought was also really cool. But I wanted to get you guys' thoughts about the way the headset looks, and I'm kind of curious if somebody was like, here's this, but they didn't say it was a game, or if you just came across it, I guess that's a better like setup. If you just came across it, would you think that this is like a headset? And there's nothing that's obvious to me as like an eyepiece if you don't know that it's a game. So I'm just kind of curious, like, in other words, like, what if it's just like a fancy bike helmet and that the eyepiece is like the back of the head, the back of the helmet to protect your skull, right? Like
different head sizes. I mean, it's a little bit complex, right? Different head shape. Yeah. But one of the things I'll say, I like that little cutscene when you put it on and you have the two eyes and then they,
yes.
I really like that. I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but I like that.
Yeah, I was just curious, like, what you guys thought about the design of it. But yeah, yeah.
I mean, I had the one thought last night, which is, and I think it would have been great comic relief in that show, but it's not that type of show, is somebody puts it on backwards, and they don't, so the, you know, clearly the eyepieces are on the back of their head, and they just hear the audio only going, not only were you not invited, but you're too stupid to play the game, and then get their head hacked off.
Yeah.
But the other thing I can see now is like, there's some idiot who's going to try to put that on like a pair of underwear.
Oh yeah. A diaper. I mean, yeah kind of like on a
it's
baby.
Like golden diaper.
Hey now.
Yeah. So. So it really interesting stuff, how they work that in into the show. Because it, you know, at first, I will say that once, you know, that it's like the third episode again, like they're ramping up to like, I don't know what this is going to be about. And I was a little bummed that it was like, oh, this VR simulated reality it's just a small part of it. I thought it was going to be the whole show is going to be like really diving into the simulation thing.
Yeah, I did too first.
But that's because there's just like all these other problems that they got to bring up and for us to talk about, you guys. So so one of those problems, I know we'll come back, I think, in and out of the simulation and the Fermi paradox and stuff. But since we're talking about problems, and this one has come up in previous episodes, the problem of lying and, you know, these conversations that Mike Evans, the character who was there in the beginning when the aliens were first contacted, and he's kind of given himself over. And it, by the way, the verbiage there, my lord, or lord, like that's really interesting to me. I'm not, there's probably some like really, really deep thing that the obvious thing is it's like a religious thing, but I think maybe there's something extra there that I just haven't quite pieced together. Why did they choose those words? Curious if that's in the book, curious if that's just like a showism. But anyway, the point is he's having this conversation with the aliens and he's reading them fairy tales and he's reading them like the Big Bad Wolf. And that's when it becomes evident that the alien species are like a hive mind. They don't have the ability to keep things to themselves. As soon as one person thinks something, everybody thinks that. Everybody's aware of the thought. So the idea of deceit and saying something that isn't true intentionally and lying is so foreign to them. And it's really kind of sad because, you know, here's Mike Evans just reading this Big Bad Wolf, like, oh, and he's, you know, he has no idea. He's like about to ruin everything because once they're like, what are you talking about? He's like, don't you ever lie? Isn't it possible for you to say something you know isn't true? And they're like, no, we're afraid of you. You're bugs. We're going to come like destroy you. Just like, oh, that's extreme.
I'm going to have to read the books to see if some of these plot holes are explained, but it's like, so they kind of paint them out to be hive mind, right? You know, we all share the same thoughts, but they're clearly not, because the first contact was somebody saying, don't answer back. I'm a pacifist, but we are right. All pacifists.
That's a good catch.
Well spotted. Yeah, for sure. But
the other thing is, I don't, to me, like, lying is what creates a lot of art. And it's not quite that straightforward, but I mean, art is, fiction especially, is I'm telling you a lie in a way that entertains you, or I'm telling a bigger truth through a lie. And like, I don't know how you develop, granted, I only have humans to look at. I don't know how you develop a technological society without that ability, because you look at so many of the modern tech things that were kind of predicted by Star Trek, the handheld communication, the handheld scanners. Those were all lies that somebody went, I can make that the truth.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very important trait to humanity, is our ability to create fiction and then take that fiction and create reality.
Yeah.
I like that.
Could I posit it, you know, again, the words, right? It's just that it all comes down to the words in the end. And the word lying, it has such a negative connotation. Whereas everything you just said, Tucker, like if we could just quickly, you know, copy that, replace all the words lied with dreams.
Yep.
Oh, man, it's like beautiful now, right? There's nothing negative. Well, I can't say there's nothing negative about dreams, but you know what I mean? I think it's some of the times the framing of it. And Bob, this is what I like about, you know, one of your rules, like always tell the truth. Did I get, is that that's the right phrasing there? Always tell the truth.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because like, yeah, always tell the truth. There's this whole realm of entertainment, like you said, Tucker, that's like based on things that aren't true. You know, even documentaries. Again, just going back to like, the truth is that third side of the story that's lost to time, man. If you're making a documentary about something, it's impossible to, you know, even if you had a video camera at the time, you're just getting that one angle. Like the truth is what happened everywhere. You'd have to have millions of cameras from every point of view to get the actual truth. So it almost seems impossible to have actual truth and in the realm of like the entertainment, you know, piece of this thing, which again is where. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, as a semantic argument, is truth conflated with fact? And I think that's the key, is, you know, fact. One would think all observers of the same fact would have the same, you know, description of said fact. The apple, it fell down, it didn't fall up, or something like that. But truth, I mean, let's do a deep callback to Contact, you know, about is it true that Ellie loved her dad?
Yeah.
How do you prove that? You know, you can't, not all observers would identify that as a fact. So having a differential between truth, which is a message, a conveyance of a signal that is accurate to the meaning of the signal. So to kind of put a funny point on this, and I do this every once in a while, like somebody asks me something, say I'm having a terrible day, and somebody asks me, you know, hey, Bob, how's your day? I say, you want the truth or you want me to lie to you?
Yeah.
Say, lie to me, Bob. I say, oh, I had a wonderful day. I did not, you know, stub my toe when I get out of bed. The water was not running cold. You know, I didn't get into traffic. You know, my dog didn't throw up on the carpet. It's a wonderful day, my friend. Thank you for asking. You know, but here's the point. The point is, once you share the understanding that what I'm about to tell you is not factually representative of my meaning, you can still get to truth, even though the words being spoken are not literally true.
Yeah. Metaphor.
There we are. it's a powerful drug. It is the thing that that gets us cooking. I mean, it really, yeah. really is. And obviously the show is expounding upon this concept of literal versus metaphorical truth. And then a secondary callback to the show with this hive mind concept. I'll throw this out there right now. We can talk about it later, but play within a play. Okay. There's an allegorical understanding, I think, of the author of this book in that he's describing communism and capitalism, roughly speaking, or freedom and oppression or whatever you want to call it. So if you think of a communistic society, you have a de facto hive mind in that, you know, there's a organized ruling position and all must comply. The beauty of the capitalist system then, as a counterpoint, would be you can change your mind, you can have a disagreement, you can think anything you want, and progress then is much more rapid. So the take-home message is, you know, people in a hive mind situation cannot deceive one another, but then you lose out on the creativity. You lose out on the, like, you know, the ability to dream, like Tucker said and you said.
Yeah.
That is the loss, is you don't have Star Trek. Nobody gets to think of Star Trek because we're all hive-minded to, you know, this little red book or whatever, some kind of, you know, manifesto and whatever. So I think that is the depth of this show is the layers, obviously. And one of the layers is this allegorical layer about a political and economic system, the tension between capitalism and communism.
Well said. Yeah. And your note in there, you were talking about, you said it reminds you of Copernicus and Galileo trying to, I think that was your note, maybe it was Tucker's, but about presenting, you know, heliocentric views in the time of religious dogmatism.
Correct. Yeah. It's hard to be taboo when the penalty is being burned at the stake or whatever. I mean, this is, and quite right. frankly, the entire show starts off with this example.
Exactly.
A physicist being beaten to death by children because he's stubborn. He will not grant that he doesn't have the right to think what he wants to think. And he is beaten to death for that thing. And this is like a historical reference. I mean, the people are doing a struggle session. They have the Mao's little red book in the crowd, you know, I mean, the all propaganda, the sloganeering, all this revolutionary concept, it was real. This is not a play. That's the real part. The real part is that stuff happened, and I'm not trying to judge one culture at one time. It's happened many times, many cultures throughout all of history, human history, obviously. But the compulsion to create a quasi hive mind where disagreement, so stability is the key. So this always comes down to like having a stability of society and having very bright lines and rigid rules, and everybody knows their place. But the counterpoint to that is how brittle that system is, how inflexible, how unyielding, how disappointing on the creative side. How do you be creative? You have to encode the creativity in a way that comes through to the reader and hides it from the oppressor.
Wow. Yes. This is good stuff. I'm really stoked about this setup and then dive into the solutions next episode. Cause yeah, a lot of really, really good stuff to just ponder, you know?
Well, and the point I'm about to make could fall in the solutions category, but I don't really want to discuss it at length there because I think the ship has sailed on that. But it's, to me, you know, the solution for the Santi is terraform a planet, terraform Mars. You know, you don't have to pick an inhabited one and fight this war with the native species. Just pick a planet that's got potential.
Yeah, we could be neighbors.
Create your own paradise there.
Yeah.
But terraforming is not a natural occurrence. No civilization starts out by creating their own environment, you know? So without the ability to lie, without the ability to create science fiction,
dream,
it never occurred to them, like, hey, we could just go create paradise.
Interesting. Yeah. Yes, they have to take something that's already been created. They have the incapacity to imagine it different than it already is. I think it's a great
facet. Their society is based more on studying what is. That's all they're doing is the actual hard science and studying what is. They're not dreaming about what could be.
Yeah. Let me do a real, this just comes to me, do a real quick offshoot onto Marxism, which is socialism. Marxism oftentimes was portrayed as a utopian solution, but it requires stuff to be there first, meaning there are very few, I can't consider knowledge of any instances of a built from scratch Marxist society where people don't have personal benefit in things, where it's all shared benefit, such that the application of Marxism is an overlay to an existing system to make it better. But Marxism is not, and I believe Marx says this himself, is not a creative system. It doesn't create the thing. It controls something that was already created that has gone astray.
Well, and I think, not that I'm hugely versed on Marxism or communism or any of that, but I think Marx's whole point was that the system he described was not going to occur until after the whole late stage capitalism and the implosion of capitalism. It wasn't something that he was saying, this is what we need to do. He was saying, when what we're doing fails, this is going to be the outcome.
But why wouldn't you be able to just start, like you're saying, a terraforming project? Take another island somewhere that's uninhabitable, create your utopia, and from there everybody will learn. Yeah. What I'm saying is his concept was, you know, destruction of the current system. People are greedy. You know, there's imbalance, inequality, class, etc. And this imbalance is inherently evil or unsustainable. But the conflict is having everything even is unchanging. It's a stasis. You know, you don't get the creativity because the dreamers are suppressed effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is all teed up for next week. How do we solve this? I wanted to ask just briefly, level two of the game. I think that's where Copernicus is Jin, but there's Galileo and Aristotle, I think. And then in level three of the game, there's Alan Turing and, oh shit, Newton, I can't remember.
Newton,
yes, Newton. Okay, so I was curious, are those NPCs? Are those other players?
That's a great question.
I think so.
Which one, NPCs or other players?
I think they're other players. And they never dive much into that, but yeah, that whole crowd of people at that gathering, those were all players.
Yes.
As far as I know.
Yes, wait, I would agree.
Crowd of people at which? Oh, at the raid or whatever.
Yeah, when people who pass is path. Introduced as the the
leader, founding or whatever.
Father, basically, of that whole movement.
Yeah,
those were all right. Other players.
And I agree.
And they were using that game to recruit scientific minds. But anyone who was, if they could detect like they're not going to help us, we should eliminate them. That was the countdown thing that they were putting in people's eyes, and or killing that. You know, I don't know if that one character, if she's like the assassin or one assassin, but you know, she takes out Jack during I'm sure there's a really deep metaphor here. I'm not as good at this as you are, Bob, but Karma Police by Radiohead is playing at the end of that episode.
Yes,
love that song. And then they played the whole thing all the way through the credits and everything, and it was like really, really well done. I'm not sure if I know exactly what the meaning behind it is. I probably should have likely thought about that to say something intelligent about it, but I like the song too much. I'm just like, this is really good. This is really like hit the spot for me, even though it was sad, you know, poor guy.
Yeah. She's an interesting character, and I hope they kind of expound on that in the future. Like, you know, is she, did she get on a plane and travel to China to kill Yi?
She must have.
Or
she was in her trailer. The scene before, she was in her trailer, right? I think, or something like that. She was bringing groceries back to her trailer or something. Her something reminded me that she was in America or wherever she was. I can't remember. But, you know, she's like in that little trailer. Like, she got shot and she crawled off. And she was like limping around for a couple episodes. And then she was like living in a trailer out in the woods or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She seems like someone who probably has grown up with the Santi, has, you know, right? Like,
yeah,
doesn't sure. know anything else, just fully invested.
Yeah, she's a fully vested cult member at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so is the assassin, the guy who tries to snipe Saul. You know, he says, when Saul asks to confront the assassin, he comes and says, "I'm sorry, I should have shot you in the head."
Oh yeah.
You know, but he's like, "You don't know me. You don't know them. Why are you doing this?" And he's like, I don't know if he says warrior for God or whatever, but I mean, effectively, he's a true believer, someone who is co-opted by the Santee's influence, right? So back to the main heart of this, there's a really interesting dichotomy between the brains that the Santee want to torture and make them kill themselves or at least stop working versus the brains that they want to bring on board to be you know, the shock troops, the first one, the tip of the spear to carry out their will on the ground now, so that they will prepare for, you know, their arrival in 400 years. So I think it's a very interesting thought experiment about who's valuable to you and who's dangerous based on, you know, how influential they are, how much they can be influenced, and also how intelligent or scientific they are.
Well, and you know, I think it's interesting, the whole concept that Ye basically came to the conclusion that, hey, we're kind of a doomed species. Go ahead and come set us.
We can't save ourselves.
Straight.
Says, yeah.
And I truly do like empathize with that idea. I'm not saying I would do what she did though, because I think sometimes the oppressor you know is better than the oppressor you don't.
Mm.
I don't know that I'd send the message she did, but I can at least empathize with the idea. Like, I have had the thought in my own personal life, like, it sure would be nice if some super smart alien species came and told us how to do this the right way, because what we're doing is not the right way.
Right.
But if they see you as bugs, then they're going to start pulling your wings off.
Yeah.
But real quick, Tucker, I had an idea now to answer your plot. Your issue with the plot as far as that first pacifist Santi. How could they have a pacifist and an aggressive Santi if they're a true hive mind? But what about this? What about it's a trick from the start? And I know they're not supposed to lie, so I can't resolve that. But it's a trick from the start in that how you would get somebody to welcome you in is to say, "Don't let me in."
Yeah. You're not allowed to do this.
Yes. Don't. Yeah.
And then watch them be like, "Bullshit, I'm going to do it anyway."
Yes. It's Tom Sawyer. You know, it's like, I love painting this fence, man. I bet you would like to paint this fence, but I'm painting this fence right now. Right? And then,
oh, wow.
You know, whatever. And then somebody comes in and says, "Hey, could you let me paint that fence for you?" Oh, I guess. It goes back to Briar Rabbit, right? Please don't
throw me. Yeah. Please don't throw me.
Please, right. Whatever you do, Mr. Wolf,
right.
Do not throw me into
that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and so there could be that. But then you have to deal with the deception angle, which they are unable to deceive. So I can't resolve that.
Well, let's put it this way. The first word I ever said was hot. But I had to touch an iron, because clearly I didn't believe what my mom was trying to tell me, that that's hot and you don't touch it. I had to perform that experiment myself and learn the hard way.
Yeah.
Yeah, this we learned the hard way. That's a good point.
Yeah, and here's a question. Do you think, you know, because this goes back to the Oscar Wilde quote from last episode, you know, education is all well and good, but it does well to remember from time to time that nothing worth knowing can be taught. So the experience, having the experience is like, my question is, do you think that's the only way? Do you think there are things that we don't have to have the experience to know, yeah, this is a bad thing? For example, our generation hasn't fought in a war the way that like our parents and our grandparents, you know, fought in world wars, right? This huge thing. Like, do you think the next generation, 2, 3, 4 generations from now, do you think they'll be able to just look back and they don't have to go and kill each other to know that's we don't need to do that? Or do you think that's a perpetual thing that you just can't, well, humans will never get away from?
I think
I have to draw like a binary between one of the two.
Well, that's what I was going to touch on is I think because everything in nature exists on a spectrum, there is no binary. You're always going to have in every generation somebody who's like a violent psychopath.
Mm.
We're never going to reach this utopia where everybody's just working together and working towards a common goal, because there's always going to be these outliers trying to tear that down.
Well, let me throw something out there that I think this dovetails nicely, is based on fear. So you're the Santi and you get this message from an unknown planet and they say, you know, hey, we're just trying to see if anybody's out there. We're curious. You know, we want to be good neighbors and all the rest. How do you know, meaning the Santi, how do you know that's not a trap? How do you know that if I go there, these people won't enslave me? And so the way to do it would be, you know, back to the thing of, I'm fearful of what I don't know. So tell them, you know, don't respond. Don't do anything. Leave us alone, so to speak. You know, we don't want to start anything. And then if you show weakness, now I attack. You know, if they, you know, because she says, hey, we need your help. We need, you know, we need to be saved, essentially. We're killing ourselves here.
Yeah, help we can't save ourselves. Yeah.
We can't save ourselves. Yeah. But imagine the response is, oh, you're a pacifist. Can you give me your address? Like, you're not going to be home tonight? Where you live? Let me go check your house out. I promise I won't touch anything. I imagine being the first contact to something and you cannot see them. You don't know anything about them. It's just so unknown. You would be filled with fear, is my point. So how would you then figure out whether I can come conquer you or you're going to come conquer me? That's a really interesting proposition.
Yeah. So to dive a little bit into the solution thing, you know, in the show, she makes that decision in 10 seconds, right? Isn't it? It's not like days go by. It's like,
no, she didn't sleep on it.
Yeah. Sleep on it. There you go. we'll pivot into something else, but let's talk about sleep in the next episode. What a brilliant solution. Sleepy got it is love it. Anyway, okay. Let's keep going through some of these things here. Oh, yes. Bob, you had mentioned you had a metaphor example you wanted to share.
Metaphor. They go into it obviously in depth. The show is effectively about this concept where there's power in the fiction, power in the lie, power in the dream to convey truth, but through understanding, meaning mutual shared assumption that what I'm telling you is not literally true. It's not a fact. There's something there you need to read into. But that's a complex situation. I've dwelt numerous hours on this concept. This is something I'm super passionate about, and I have distilled out a concept of the value of metaphor into two main components. One is information compression, and the other is information encryption. So being able to compress a vast, vast library of knowledge into a small label. Let's just say I say Buddhism. If I say Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam or something, I'm sure there are many millions of humans that could expound upon that one label for hours and days and months and years.
Right.
But it's all encapsulated in one single label. Encryption. I'm going to call back to a very famous episode on Star Trek Next Generation called Darmok. And in Darmok, if anybody recalls, Picard meets an alien race that does nothing but speak in metaphor. They're incapable of literal conversation. And so the universal translator, through the, you know, the deck screen, whatever you want to call that thing, they have a universal translator. All the words make sense. Literally, the words are understandable, but the meaning behind them is nonsensical because there's no shared experience of what the metaphor really represents. And it does not resolve until Picard and the captain of the other ship go down onto the planet and they have, you know, trials and tribulations. And through this contextualization, Picard is able to build in the understanding of what the metaphors are meaning. And now to the real point. There's a mathematical representation of this, where if you could create, say, a spreadsheet of infinite size and randomly distributed with letters, all the characters of, you know, alphabet and spaces and punctuation, etc. Imagine just everything randomly distributed in a spreadsheet form, infinitely large. There is some string of randomly created letters that just by chance create a sentence. Let's just say happy birthday. Say, I want to say happy birthday to somebody. And somewhere out there in this infinite spread of this spreadsheet, randomly is happy space birthday. Exclamation point. Maybe it's got your name in it. But for me to send it to somebody, all I would have to do is send the first cell address and the last cell address. So the two endpoints.
Yeah.
And if I gave you those two endpoints and you have the same spreadsheet as I do, looks random, but it's exactly the same. So there's no pre-planning of the where the positions of all the letters and characters are, but we have copies. I give you the first. Now, let's just expand on happy birthday. Let's just say it's War and Peace. Let's just say it's some giant novel. I could give you the very first character and the very last character address. And everything in between, you could go read on your spreadsheet. So there's a way to compress and encrypt this information by using labels that are completely separate from the message itself. So if I give you, let's just say Excel. So you have columns and you have rows. And all the columns are letters and all the rows are numbers. So I give you A1 to A4044. Well, in that stretch is the message that I want to convey to you, John and Tucker. But the label has nothing to do with the message. Mm. I don't even have to encrypt it. It doesn't matter. I can tell you, meaning my enemy, exactly what the address of the first cell is and exactly what the address of the last cell is. Good luck. Good luck. You will never figure it out. It's impossible. So it's a maximizing tool, metaphor is, to encrypt and encode information. And that's what I think the bulk of you know, one of the main layers of this story is.
I love the whole infinite spreadsheet thing, because to expound on that, if you're talking infinite, not only does it have every sentence, word, novel ever written somewhere in there, it has every possible.
Ever will be written.
It literally has the equation that solves, you know, the unification of quantum physics and general relativity. It's in there.
It sure does. And by the way, I'm glad you brought that up, Tucker, because there is one piece of special sauce in here, and that is time. So the person who's making the message to be received, they have to spend time searching the spreadsheet for this magic combination, this one in a trillion combination. Once I've got that, I can give it to you. And you just go look it up right now. It takes no time at all. So the investment is all about the energy and time it takes to do the initial search, to find the hidden randomness that matches what I want to convey. When I give it to you, you just plug it in and there it is. By the way, I have made this. This is not a hypothetical. I have created this spreadsheet. It's not infinite, obviously, but it proves my point in that you can create a spreadsheet that the ability to match randomness between two people is the key here. So it takes a little bit of special sauce to figure out how to create the initial random setup that can then be reproduced by somebody else very simply and easily without that being, because if that gets intercepted, so you're trying to encrypt an information, encrypt a message. If someone intercepts the build of the spreadsheet itself, it defeats the purpose. Mm-hmm. So there is like a little extra piece in there on how to create something that can be reproduced that is as random as random can be and infinite and representative of all these, you know, letters and symbols, etc.
So the key to unlocking the secrets of the universe is to create not only the infinite spreadsheet, but a useful search function.
That's hard. So that's, it goes back. But by the way, this is a great Simpsons reference. So Mr. Burns and Smithers are walking into a room full of monkeys smashing on typewriters.
And
Burns picks up the first monkey's page. He says, "It was the best of times. It was the blurst of times."
Yeah.
And then he like smashes the monkey or something like that. So yes, there's a problem, a paradox in that in an infinite display of information, every solution is in there. But yeah, how do you go through it? That's exactly
because there's also an infinite number of solutions that are one letter off.
Correct.
Yeah.
And on it goes and on it goes and on it goes. So the real factor here is time. So the sender has to search and find this pattern in the randomness that does actually make sense. It is actually the right thing. And that takes all the special sauce. So being able to find that initial pattern is inherently difficult and it makes this problematic. But I think that goes to the heart of the beauty of the story itself. And we'll get into all the different metaphors that are being used, but it ends up being a technique that humans use to communicate amongst each other such that the Santee cannot detect the meaning of the message.
Very interesting. Did we talk about the Library of Babel before?
I don't believe so.
Shame on me if I haven't shared this with you, but it's your spreadsheet. Somebody built this, but it's not a spreadsheet, but it's a little bit different, but it's this guy put this website out there that just in the same way you're describing a spreadsheet having like all possibilities, it's the same idea. It's like a library. It's categorized by like book, like room, maybe book, page, whatever, but it's every combination of at least I think it's you know, the 26 letters of the alphabet and a space maybe. But I would you know, when we're done here, like, carve some time out to Library of Babel .info, or you just Google Library of Babel. It's kind of, I've read through it. It's kind of hard to explain, but it is described really well. And basically you can just search for any string of text up to, it should be like right in front of me, but I'm not seeing it, but it's,
and it tells you what room to go into.
It's like here's the page that has that exact sequence of characters, maybe 200 characters at most or something.
It's
really gnarly. Highly recommend checking that out. I'll put a link in the show notes, by the way, because it's the same thing. It's just, it's not a spreadsheet, but it's the same idea, you know.
This thing, it also jiggles the handle on a further memory I've got of a concept where trying to figure out consciousness, and I'll be brief. Imagine you're in a room and there's a slot, and like someone puts a tube through the slot and it says, here's a location on a bookshelf, and the books are all behind you. And you go walk and you find the shelf and it's, you know, E4, and you find the book and it's the third book or whatever. And it says page number such and such. And you go and look at this page. The books are all written in a language you don't understand, but you copy the reference, put it in the envelope or tube or whatever, and put it back out. What if this is cognition or consciousness, such that you're getting a question prompted to you? You go find the answer somewhere. You don't know what it is, but you have a location, like a memory of this is the place where it is, like the Babel thing. You go grab it, you transcribe it, push it out the door. Did you ever understand what just happened?
Yeah, interesting.
So there is definitely something there about having all the answers available if you can find it and then understand it. I think that is the crux, is like locating this information or manifesting it, and then also understanding it. It's two separate steps, is my point. So there's the knowledge of this is where it's at, I've got the right answer, and then there's the understanding of why is it the right answer.
Right. Yeah, I love that. You said you did put a spreadsheet together. I don't know if that's something you shared with me before, but I love spreadsheets. So
it's on my website. It's on my website. Yeah. It's so if.zone, and it's in the maths and physics page. And I've got many examples of my spreadsheets that I put up. They're unlabeled other than the name. My apologies. But I think it starts, I can't remember the name of them, it's been so long. I think it starts with star, things like Stardust or something like that, or star something. Because the first thing I wanted to do was make a working copy that I created this giant spreadsheet. And the way you create it is through a very simple set of rules that repeat over and over and over again. So I could give you a starting position and like literally just two digits, a starting position. And then there's a couple very simple rules, and the rest all flows from that. So if you don't know the starting position, there's no way to reproduce the spreadsheet in totality, and all the rules extend infinitely. And you can put a essentially like a weighted map of all the letters and characters that overlay, you know, based on the numbers that are produced. And what I did is I created this thing. By the way, the key is you do like three letters at a time. You don't do one letter. One letter takes a long friggin' time. But if you put three random letters in each cell, it goes much quicker. And I think it was Stardust. I want to say Stardust. But anyway, I made this thing that if you type in what you want the thing to say, it'll search for it. And the secret here, by the way, is so cool. The addresses themselves become ponderous. So imagine you have trillions and trillions of cells, and you're trying to encode a billion characters in War and Peace or whatever. Like your address from the starting position to the ending position might be more information than is actually within the book itself when you really expand this. So to search for that is difficult. So the way I did it was it searches, and each line it searches, it then deletes. And so it doesn't keep on, because it would slow the computer down. Like as the computer is trying to, just a tiny program, trying to figure out what the next string is that I have to analyze, it would slow it down the further it got down on the list. So I inverted it, and I just had it delete each line. And so it's always the first line that it's searching. So it keeps the address small, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense.
Wow. But, yeah, I think I kind of follow. I feel like I need to get my hands on this, dude. I love it.
I've got it in there. And here's the coolest part. It was like Stardust or whatever. I can't remember what I used. It was like Stardust. No, it's like Supernova. That's what it was. It's Supernova. Now I remember. Supernova is the name of the spreadsheet. And I found the word Supernova in, I think it's like 9 characters or something like that, in a pretty significantly large spreadsheet. I had to create a significantly large spreadsheet. But if you type in what you want, in, I did up to 9 characters, it will then search the entire spreadsheet until it finds it. And it gives you the address then. And so then whoever has the matching spreadsheet, I just send them the address. And then they type in their response. And it might take a week or an hour or whatever to go find the thing. But then once it comes back, I can just give you the first position and the last position. And you know the answer.
I love it.
That's slick.
Yeah, that's very neat. I'm kind of jealous I didn't come up with that. So.
Well, now we can share it, and you can look at it and critique it and improve it. Because guess what? There's not another human being other than my wife who's ever seen this thing, and nobody cares, literally, but me. So
I know the feeling, you know, sometimes like write a haiku or something, and I'm like, hey, guys, check this out. And it was like, good job, nobody buddy.
90% of the population is like, you lost me at spreadsheet. And then Dale's like, you had me at spreadsheet.
I know, yes.
Well, exactly. My wife actually got me a present that said, I'm trying to remember what it says. It's something about Excel. And it's like, people are jealous that you like Excel. They spreadsheet about you or something like that. It's very clever.
Oh, so, I get it.
It's a little plaque I have, yeah. But the truth is, Tucker, when you say Excel or spreadsheet, it turns off 99.999% of everybody who's ever listened to anything I've ever said. So
I don't get it. I love spreadsheets.
They're handy. You're the 0.00001.
That's funny. Oh man. I feel like I want to try to like get back to some more problems from Three Body Problem. I don't think we actually talked about it too much prior to this, but what do you guys think about like the nanotech that is described in the show?
Love it.
And you know, I mean, it's first introduced as this experimental kind of thing. I think they say it's like an artificial diamond, but it's in the shape of a cube. And it's on this platform that rises up where there's invisible nanofibers. It doesn't look like anything's happening to it. And even I think somebody says, did it work? And she's like, yep. And she just kind of knocks this cube and it falls apart because these invisible nanofibers sliced columns out of this cube. And then the next time we see that technology, it's slicing through a huge oil tanker and slicing through people. It's very brutal, very gnarly. So yeah, that's kind of the bit that we get about nanotech in the show. What do you guys think?
So here's my thought on it. And I don't know that it ever gets addressed in the book or the show, but if you have something that is that small, that it's literally basically sliding through the molecular bonds of atoms and cells, how do you hold that? You know, they created those steel beams to hold the strings. Well, what's stopping those strings from just cutting through the anchors that are holding them?
What about this? I don't know if you guys are fly fishermen, but I fly fish. And you have a kind of a leader. It's a tapered leader. So the tip of this thing, and if you know what a leader is, it's the thing you put at the end of your line. So it's the clear part. So you have a float line, like your dry fly fishing. You have a float line on your reel, which is, say, neon orange, so you can see it. And then the last 10 feet is invisible monofilament. But they taper it so that to the base, it's something you can work with. It's physical. You could actually tie a knot. And at the tip, it is fine as a human hair.
Mm.
So I would say you could taper this substance just off the top of my head. But it's a great, great point, though. I like it.
Yeah. And it's not only the way when it's slicing through, you know, again, it in the introduction scene, the block, it's not obvious. Like as the nanofibers are cutting through it, it's not falling apart. You know, and I think that was intentional because as the oil tanker is, you know, sailing through these nanofibers, the oil tanker isn't falling apart either. Things that are more brittle, like, you know, there's the hallway with like paper cutouts from the school or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. The hose, you know, the people. So there must be
brutal, impactful scene. It viscerally caught me off guard. I haven't been impacted by, you know, obvious CGI stuff like that. I mean, it's not like a Faces of Death kind of a thing where it's like, eek. I mean, you know, it's not real, obviously,
but right.
Man, it caught me viscerally. And I realized I had a deep, deep seated memory of a sci-fi book. And I believe it is The Fountains of Paradise. Mm. And this is Asimov, I believe. And it's about a space elevator. And it's a really interesting book. But the thing that I recall, and I could be making this up, by the way, I haven't reread the book. But the thing I recall from a kid was the guy or one of the guys working on this space elevator or the test of it. The thing is like invisible. And he moves his hand where the filament is. And it's under immense tension because there's a orbiting satellite that's on the other end of this thing. That's a space elevator. And his fingers just fall off. Like Tucker says, it just like literally goes between the bonds. You know, it's like literally just cleaner than any scalpel, you know, painless at first. You don't even know. You don't even know. It's just like a puff of wind or something just breaks you apart. And that thing stuck with me for all those years. I probably read this when I was 12 years old or something.
Wow.
But that was such an impactful moment for whatever reason. it really brought out like an emotional response when they used that tech to destroy that ship. That was amazing.
Wow. Yeah, I wonder if that was a source of inspiration for the author.
Well, my thought when that was happening, though, was they talked about the possibility, you know, we go in guns blazing, they'll just destroy it.
Yeah, that was the whole point. They're
how
to get a hard
did they like justify like you're gonna cut this ship into 50 slices and just hope that like that the hard drive is between two of those slices?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought of that too.
There's no perfect solution,
I assume. Meaning,
sure.
Unless like you can't even gas them because there's enough air vents and stuff. Like, how would you? I don't think there is a perfect solution that would incapacitate 1,000 people instantaneously before they know what's happening. So,
well, I would say that I think the tech is here now, and that's the microwave type technology that has been developed. I don't know if you guys have read about the Havana syndrome at all.
Yes.
They basically think the Russians are using a directed energy weapon on some of our operatives around the world that is causing literal damage to these people's brains, creating traumatic brain injuries using basically a microwave gun.
Wow. I do have an answer for this. I think it's a great pattern recognition of, you know, a tool that is invisible and instantaneous and, you know, indetectable and all that stuff. But there is an inherent flaw with microwaves in that they're very long wavelength. And you'll realize this in your microwave where it only cooks in the middle. So what happens is the microwaves are bouncing around inside your microwave. I think they're like 10 or 12 centimeter waves, I believe. And only where they kind of reinforce each other in a certain zone do you get this impact. Now, obviously, that's, you know, creating excitation in hydrogen, you know, water molecules. It's not the same thing as Savannah syndrome. But I think the problem is focusing this on such a large target would be impossible, essentially.
Well, and to shoot holes in my own theory, for that to work, you'd have to have some sort of shielding for your own people where they could go operate in that environment while those people are being incapacitated.
That too. Yeah. And how do you know that doesn't potentially disrupt the, you know, the
storage mechanism? Yeah.
Storage mechanism. Yeah. I think that this is a really interesting conundrum and a plot device to solve the conundrum of, they've got whatever, you know, petabytes, hundreds of petabytes on this thing, this tiny little disc or whatever. How would you go take that from somebody? I was very interested. It really is. I'm curious. Like, this is a great solution artistically to a concept of a floating city where you could blow it up, no problem. You could, you know, sink it, no problem. How are you ever going to get useful stuff off if they don't want you to? I think that's a really interesting problem.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
I actually like the sinking method as a, I think that would have been my solution. Sink it in a body of water that you know you have a high chance to go in and recover that afterwards.
You guys aren't going to believe this. You said submarine? I said you guys aren't going to believe this, but that's how Mission Impossible 7 starts, you guys. And the prisoner dilemma is in there and everything. It's really good. Just saying, I don't want to spoil too much, but I could, but especially... I'll spoil it for Tucker sometime because he probably won't watch it anyway. But yeah, it's there, dude. It's exactly what you guys are talking about.
I think you're right, awesome. Though, because I'm trying to imagine myself as the shipmates. And if you could create like a whirlpool or some way to sink that thing immediately, like within a minute or something, I don't think there's any human who could fight the urge to escape in order to delete the information. And obviously you could recover it when you sink it and use submarines to capture the whole ship or whatever. So I think you're right. I think that's probably, if you could find a way to sink that ship within, you know, 60 seconds or 3 minutes or something like that.
I mean, you could have used one of those nano strings just to cut the entire 3-foot bottom off and that thing's going down pretty quick at that point.
That's a good point. And just
the
terror,
and you don't have to kill everybody. Oh no.
Yeah, right. But everybody's gonna those people are all dead as dog shit. I mean, there's no way they were ever gonna make it out.
The scene where she's walking around the wreckage and it's just that little girl's foot with a shoe on it. Like, that could have been avoided, maybe.
I know. What are you guys doing?
But war is hell, right?
That sucks. Yeah, that's a great tension, though. I really like that tension of going back to, say, like Oppenheimer or something, right? Like, what are you guys doing? You geniuses. What are you doing? Are you creating or are you destroying here? And they're making creative destruction and justifiable through the warped morality of warfare and all the rest. I mean, it becomes fucked up. Just be honest. It becomes fucked up to think about your career in science and then having an application of your discovery, your product that is antithetical to your morality. That's a tough one.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I don't know if this is a good time to bring up like the Sofons technology that they describe. And I don't know if that's exactly what caused it, but the universe winking, I think at the end of episode 2, maybe, and the countdowns, like, these Santi have this ability to make people see what they want to see. Actually, let's talk about the blinking universe, because, you know, when I think it was episodes 6 or 7 that they describe the Sofons, or it's explained what they are. And there is this imagery of the world kind of being, you know, enveloped with this like sort of blanket just covering the sky. And then there's this big eye in the sky. Like, did that happen, or did they just make everybody see? Cause like with the stars blinking, that didn't really happen. They made everybody think that's what they were seeing, or was there really this blanket across covering the entirety of the globe, and they, you know, make it transparent so you can see the stars, and then they just make it black and then transparent again? Like, what do you guys think was actually happening with
I can't say if it's a plot hole or if it's just something that hasn't come up yet, but to me, the way I took it is that those Sofons have the ability to unfold themselves again. And so what they did is they unfolded one of those Sofons and wrapped it around the planet, and then were able, using the computer printed on that photon, to project an image. Whether, you know, it was the eye the second time, but the first time it unfolded, it made it projected all the stars as being much brighter. Because remember, you said, I think it was Saul who said, I don't think I've ever seen the stars look so bright.
Right.
And they're looking up at the stars, and it's like,
that
is not a night sky on Earth. And then they start blinking.
Yeah. There's a
third example of this, by the way, and that's when Wade and Jin are trying on the headsets, and they go into the game, and the lady, the assassin lady, whatever, not the assassin, the sword lady, the lady cuts your head off. And she explains what's happening. That's exactly right. It's an unfolding through extra dimensions. So I'm not going to go deep into that because that's on the solution side, but let me give
example,
real quick example of the concept here. So between two points, you have a line. So there's length, okay? And that's can be measured as distance. When you add a second dimension, you now have surface area. So you have length and width. It's like a piece of paper. So length and width has surface area. That's not something length has. So when you have two dimensions, you can have more stuff than in one dimension. And then obviously at a third dimension, you can have volume. And now you can think in your mind's eye of a string stacked next to a string stacked next to a string stacked next to a string, and that creates a page. And you could do that. And then you could take a page on top of a page on top of a page on top of a page and create a cube. You could do that. But the point is, as you add dimensionality, you have, so I love this word or this phrase, it's called more spacious space. And that comes from Flatland, by the way, which is a fabulous book I highly recommend. But the author of Flatland creates this terminology. As you go up in dimensionality, you have more spacious space. So every time you add a dimension, there's like another up and down. There's another place for stuff to go that you can't even look at in your dimensionality. And so the concept is there's 10 dimensions. the Zanti use all their technology to unwrap these 10 dimensions and create this very expansive blanket that they can then unravel over the planet and encapsulate us and then deceive us from what's actually happening. So that's kind of the short of it.
And man, I read one of the articles somebody shared last night that did a really, probably the best job of describing the dimensions beyond the third that I've ever read. And I know I'm going to butcher it because it was late when I read this, but it, I mean, it was basically you get up to a certain dimension and you can basically see all possible outcomes, past and future, for every universe. And to me, that's like another kind of plot hole where it's like, if they had the ability to manipulate these dimensions, are you really telling me that fighting the violent murder apes for their planet was the best possibility out of all of those universes? Like,
yeah,
there
yeah,
had right. to have been an easier solution. Like,
yeah, well, maybe it goes back to, again, like if they can't dream about potentially true. Like moving in next door on Mars and making that theirs and just like howdy neighbor and being cool.
Well, just maybe, why not instead of four light years away, just go to a different star system in your own galaxy.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, let me throw one quote out here because I don't think there'll be a better place to use this. And it's that Feynman quote from the beginning, the episode one. It doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is. If it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong.
Yeah.
And the point I bring that up is, and this will go to the solutions episode, so this is just foreboding. What if the higher levels of dimensionality that were discussed in that article you talk about, Tucker, what if that's wrong? And so my point would be, what if you cannot go higher up and see all possibilities like that? And I'll expound next time. But that would be my counterpoint. It's a great theory. It's beautiful. But perhaps experimentally, it will not match with reality.
Well, and I would also argue that, I mean, once you get to that highest dimension, that's basically God mode.
Correct.
Is any sentient creature built of atoms ever going to be able to comprehend that type of view? Probably not.
Agreed as well. Yeah.
You basically have to have a brain as big as the universe to even begin to understand that much information.
You would have to evolve in that 10 accessible dimensional region in order, following this line of inquiry. You would have to evolve within that. So your brain would have to be that dimensional, etc., in order to comprehend and use the abilities in the higher dimensions as described, which is, by the way, super beautiful. I love the description of the progress of dimensionality and how each one sheds more and more light. And it does follow with this concept of added dimensions give you more up and down, give you more access to different areas. I like that, but I'll have a different twist on it next time. But that's my take home, is perhaps that's not as correct as people think it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. Looking forward to that. As we're kind of getting near the hour and a half mark here, why don't we pivot into this last question? So by the way, like, I think we did a pretty good job so far. Like, there's still some more problems. I think we can still focus the next episode on the solutions, but maybe a couple more problems comes up that we didn't quite go over. Like, but yeah, great job keeping the solutions, you know, in the back burner for now. And I don't think this thing is a solution type of thing, but it is another kind of problem. This character, Will, who's going to die from pancreatic cancer anyway, and there's this opportunity for him to, for his brain to be put in this box and cryofroze, right? I mean, it's like in stasis.
Stasis.
And be launched out towards the incoming Santi. They're not going to be here for 400 years, but, you know, nobody. Or Wade, he's like, I think he says, like, I'll be damned if I die before my organization's completed, fuck all, or whatever he says.
Yeah, you know,
I have to do something. And anyway, And so they have this elaborate, this staircase project of continual nuclear explosions, just accelerating this probe to, you know, a fraction of the speed of light. You know, I think it was like 1,000 nuclear explosions that would, you know, and they had to be literally threading the needle. I think they use the phrase just to get close to the Santee and then hope. I'm sure that's spelled out more in the book and, you know, the second season, but it wasn't really clear to me, like, what exactly are they hoping to happen? But
they
the point was
information in like 200 years, not 400 years. I think that was the
point.
We meet them just halfway. Yeah.
Just to try to get something sooner. Yeah. And so, you know, this guy Will is going to die anyway. And he's like, sure, I'll have my brain put in this box and launched out. And I know, Bob, you were curious, like, what would we do? Do you want to go first, Bob, or?
I would definitely not do it. As of right now, the concept terrifies me beyond belief. I think Tucker has some good examples of this, so I'm not going to make a bunch of examples. But the loss of control and the uncertainty is something I think it would be hard pressed for any human to be the first one to do such a thing, to allow themselves to be either forever in space in this not dead, not alive place, or captured by alien enemies and conceivably experimented upon like a bug for all, you know, for forever. And I don't know if I could counterbalance that with the positives of I get to meet an alien or something like that. I mean, that's kind of cool. You know, I don't get to die. That's kind of cool. But I don't know, man. I just don't think I could do it. I think I would not be able. I would be like Saul. And Saul on the bed at the end, right before Will plugs in the numbers to commit suicide or whatever, so he can be his brain extracted. I don't think I could put it any better than that. Like, that is to me the most terrorizing, crazy hell. That's a hell. That's literal hell. Loss of all control, but having to potentially experience something forever. I don't know. I can't, it just puts me off. It really does.
Yeah. Very heavy.
Yeah. There's no way for me. Like I said, I already wrote a story about the whole concept of drifting through the universe for eternity. Just no, there's no way. Like, I think part of the human machine is that you kind of have a choice when it ends. Not always. I mean, you can be taken out by any number of things, but, you know, you always have the option to turn off. And I think it happens a lot with older and sick people where they kind of just decide it's their time and their body kind of goes, all right, you know, it's
right.
It's time. And they pass fairly quickly. Not having that option, that's hell.
Mm.
Like, you have to have the option to turn the suffering off.
Could you go into a little bit more detail on that story? I know the story because we've discussed it, but I think it's valuable to expound upon what, like, really put it in your mind, what we're talking about. What?
So my story was basically, it was a punishment for a crime by a very heavy-handed government, and their idea of a life sentence was basically, we're going to remove your brain and all the nerves. We're basically, we have that's what it was. They had nanomachines that basically ate everything except your brain and all your nerves. Everything else was gone. And then they put that in some sort of capsule that could keep that brain alive forever and just railgunned you into space to drift for eternity. And so you're basically, the prison is your own mind. You're still there, but you don't have any external stimulus. You still have all your nerves, but it's nothing but your thought. And how long does it take you to go insane at that point? You know, a day, a week?
Do you go insane and then do you float back into sanity and then go back out into insanity?
Let's say it takes 100 years to go insane. Okay, well then you're insane for eternity. No, it's terrifying. There's no way I would do it. There's no way. And the flip side of that is, even say, like, okay, they do pick your brain up, and they do find a way to, you know, turn you back on and say they're nice, say they don't torture you, and you're still just a brain, dude. Like, you're still just, you're you without any,
you're vulnerable,
free will. You have no ability to affect anything. You're just your thought, and that's, no, I don't want to be that.
Like, no, well, agency. You could do nothing. You're just,
yeah, agency. That's the word I was looking for.
Well, it was so interesting in the show because they seem pretty confident that the Santee are advanced enough. Like, oh yeah, they'll be able to reconstruct his body, no problem. Obviously, like they're just like, for sure, they'll be able to do that if they want. If they want to just like put him in a new body, they'll be able to do that. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
where that confidence comes from.
But it's that disconnect for me where it's like they're so powerful that they can do anything. But then why are they coming here? Like,
yeah,
Earth, they're not evolved to live on Earth.
Well, go back to the allegory, though. Think about communism as a very strong thing. Like, it has strength, but it also has brittleness. And this is the tension of the allegory, that the strength of unity is, especially over time, like imagine millions of years and you have this unity. It would just be unimaginable to think about anybody else having independence and differing thoughts. I think that's really what it's coming down to, is the unawareness of their style from our style, meaning they're both valid styles. Let's be honest. Communism or socializing communities, let's say tribalism. Okay, let's go simple, tribalism. Obviously, this was in our past. This is how we got here. Like, you couldn't just go be whatever you want when there's a 200-person tribe. You got to be part of the team, my brother. You don't get to decide. You're in it for the team. Your decision is the team's decision. The team's decision is your decision. They're inextricably linked. We have the luck of being born in a time when we have freedom to decide. We have independence. We have the ability to specialize. Okay, think about that. Think about inability to specialize. Everybody's the same. Everybody's sharing this hive mind. So I think that's really a foundation level concept here of the tension between the strength of unity and the strength of independence and individualism.
Yeah. And it is, because if you look at the beginning of the show, it's like you have one of your nation's best physicists pushing logs up a ramp.
Yeah.
Is that really the best use for her?
It's equality. Probably not. It's equality. Yeah. Yeah.
We can all push a log. Doesn't mean we all should.
No.
Interesting.
And that point is also brought up. I love that point, Tucker. That point is brought up in the hospital scene with Will and his sister and brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah. When
he brings up the point, you had the gift. Like, you had this gift, you were promoted, you were given education, you had this thing, and she was a waitress in a filing cabinet or whatever, you know, like she didn't. And so there is a thing, meaning imagine you have 99% of the population. I'm not saying this is true, I'm just saying, what if 99% of the population, they're waitresses and filers. 1% is Einstein. Like, do the waitresses and the people who do filing, do they really want to kill Einstein because he gets to go to university? Like, none of us would be richer over that. And so there's an inherent problem there of inequality. But the ones that race out in front, they bring us all along. They make new maps. You know, they create new understanding that none of us could ever understand. So I think there is something inherently, like a first principles understanding here that's in play. That's very beautiful.
Agreed. So for my answer, would I do what Will did? Yeah, sign me up. Let's go. No, I just, you know, today, if I had to make the decision today, I'm too happy with my life. Like, you know, but this will be a surprise. But yeah, can I say I would never do it? Ah, man, I don't know. Dude. I don't know what the future is going to be like. And
yeah, only feels in absolute, so I can't say never. But.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, part of it is like someday, because to contrast with all this, potentially, if I you know, we're talking about stasis. I mean, Will isn't aware. His brain is stasis. Is it anesthetized? Is he under general anesthesia?
I think it's frozen to the point that basically there is no activity. It's basically dead, and they're hoping that, you know, they can bring him back in some way that he is a functional individual. Yeah. But
the counterpoint, I don't know. The counterpoint, though, and this we didn't have time to go into today. That's fine, but. Because we've beaten this metaphorical horse metaphorically to death already. But the metaphor is he's in this little paper boat that Jin had made.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's a moment where it's raining, and then there's a moment when the rain turns off. And I think the implication is he's going to be in that boat forever. And so my thought was 1 second in that boat might take 1,000 years or whatever. So everything's slowed down, but it's not gone. So he's still there, but his subjective time. It's like going next to a black hole or something. Time gets wonky, right?
Right.
Like if you're near a gravitational attractant, you have one kind. And if you're, you know, anyway, the point is he's in this boat. So he gets to experience the boat for all eternity. So I don't know if he's technically turned off or not.
Yeah, that's really interesting thing to consider. I don't, you know, none of us read the book. We don't know where it's going. Who knows, but that's because they made the point to do these paper boats, you know, in a couple episodes. Yeah, that's really intriguing to think about that way. Just put potential prediction about where this is going, maybe because by the way, I realized at the very beginning it should have been like spoiler alert. I'll put that in the actual description of the episode.
Mega spoilers.
We're talking about all of it, but so the staircase, you know, the last episode of the season, you know, shows them doing this, trying this staircase thing, which again just seems like a tiny, tiny likelihood that all 1,000 nuclear bombs will go off exactly. I mean, they even show it. They're literally this nanofiber sail that's going to catch the explosion and, you know, catch that power and be the reason that it's continuing to accelerate. That sail has this little hole in the middle, and you know, the hole is there for the nuclear bomb to like just pass through, so that as soon as the bomb is on the other side of the sail, that's when it explodes. It is a little weird. Like, what is the material used that's
connecting the sail to?
And they don't.
That kind of ties into what I said about the nanofibers. The weak point is where it's attached, and they actually showed that. You know, the cable snaps off.
True.
Satellite. That's because
the whole point, right?
How do you hold something that's designed to basically be stronger than any other material?
Yeah.
You'd have to build the whole thing out of nanofibers.
Yeah, the whole thing's got to be nanofibers. But the point is taken that there was a weakness or a design flaw, and that one failure obviously is disastrous. So
And that was after like 3 or 4 explosions, right? I mean,
yeah, it was pretty early on.
1,000, like they had to go through 1,000 just to, you know, it did seem like a moonshot. I think people might consider that like a moonshot type of a goal, you know, like,
but I really like Wade's point of view, which is, you know, number one, having a human in the capsule makes it real. People really take it much more seriously. And number two, you got to try, like you got to
iterate.
And obviously our motto is iterate and curate. So you got to kind of try these things. And final point on this, Wade's take home, different between the program itself and the plan itself. His plan obviously is to always progress, right? Always move forward. And so I think that's a powerful delineation from the concept of, you know, strength through a static dogma. So constant change, try new things, break it, fix it forever. Right. And that is like the heart of our progress in the last 100 years, is the freedom to try new things. And obviously that freedom comes with responsibility, meaning when things don't go well, that's on you, you know, but without trying,
Yeah.
You're kind of not doomed, but you're stuck in a single place.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And that's I do kind of have an issue with how Augie views Wade. You know, she's just constantly, well, he's a monster. And it's like, dude, you're facing forced extinction. Like,
yeah.
All the cards are on the table, man. When your back's up against that kind of wall, nothing is off limits. Nothing.
Yeah.
I think she's dealing with that literal subjective experience of seeing the child's foot kind of a thing.
Sure.
Can't get past that. Can't get
right. Can't get traumatized, dude.
Traumatized. Yeah,
it's PTSD.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. So yeah, 3-4 explosions in, the cable snaps, and Will is off in a different direction. Like, okay, iteration one. My prediction is some other alien race who's been observing the whole time was like, hey, we'll help him. And they're going to be the good guys, and they're not a hive mind, and they are creative, and they dream, and, you know, and it's going to be everyone who lives happily ever after. That's my prediction.
Hey, one more tag on this, and unless Tucker, you have a prediction. I don't have a prediction. I don't know where it goes with this. I think John's answer is as good as any. But I do have one more question about the same topic. When Wade comes with that that document, the Pledge of Allegiance, so to speak, to humanity, what did you guys think and feel about that moment, that scene? Where Will refuses to sign this thing. And
you know, I did like that because it's, yeah, to me, you know, it's like, I'm making this sacrifice. I'm choosing to do this. That's my choice. I'm not doing it. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I agree with his idea. What if he gets on that ship and they resurrect him and he's like, you know what? These people are better than us. You know, yeah. That's a very real possibility that, you know, these people are better than us. This is a civilization that's viable to exist long term. It has that foresight not to shit where it eats and destroy the planet they live on. I think they've got a better option.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
About you?
Yeah, because I have to remind me the detail again. It was, what was the contract saying? Like,
you will do nothing but work for the benefit of humanity, and your allegiance is with humans and Earth, and
yeah,
you know, essentially, yeah. it's like a nationalistic thing or a you know, bigger than nations, but it's more like a tribalistic thing. Not, mm-hmm. It didn't say like we're the best. It just says you have to be in allegiance and never do anything against Earth or humans.
Right. Yeah. You know, maybe the absurdity of it kind of strikes me. Like, so even if he did sign it, like, and like Tucker, if you know what you said, if they pick him up and he's like, oh, actually, yeah. 200 years from now, like, what are they, you know, like. And then the Santi show up with Will, and someone's like, hey, you signed this thing 200 years ago. Shame on you. You said you wouldn't, like, it almost seems like a pointless thing. And then on the other hand, I guess, you know, it's the fear of the people, like, hey, we know we're sending you out here. Like, this is just going to make us feel better if you do this. So I guess I see that side of it. But, yeah. You know, it's Will's decision. He's the one that's signing it. So, yeah, I completely respect the idea that, they're basically asking him, like, predict the future and for sure agree that XYZ will not happen, as you know, as long as you're breathing or whatever, you know. It does seem like kind of absurd, and I appreciate the idea of, because he doesn't sign it, right? He does not. Yeah. And good then, for him. It seems more like pragmatic that way. Like, I don't I know. What are you, why are you? Yeah. Very honest.
But yeah. but Wade then turns it around as he's leaving and shows that it was essentially not a trick, but essentially a tool to motivate the Santi to pick him up, meaning he's our man because he's not our man. That's what he's
saying. That's right. Sort of, I forgot about that. The concept
of, which I thought was genius level.
Yeah. Really well done.
I was really off put the first time it happened. being the first time I watched it, excuse me, I was really off put and I didn't understand it. I felt inherently biased towards humans. And that's a weird thing to say, because why shouldn't I be? Why wouldn't I be? How couldn't I be? But is it really the best way? And so it is a mind twister, in that to conceive of a possibility that there is something better to be allegiant with other than your biological kin or something, it is hard to grasp. But I think there is a real nugget of interesting truth there.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say one more thing about the whole Will story, because it kind of drove me up the wall that he chickened out and never told her how he felt.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of had I like the way I wrote it down last night. And it's that if you truly love someone, then that love is not based on the reciprocation of your love.
Yeah.
Now, I know loving someone and being in love with somebody, those are two different things. But to me, like, you have to love somebody before you're in love with them. So at least speak that truth, man. That's like, put that out there. And as they show in the show, like, that's something she probably would have wanted to hear.
Yeah. There was a moment. I don't disagree. I think in spirit, you're right, Tucker. And that's exactly what happened. He wasted his chance at love, or reciprocal love, excuse me. But he does say, I will give him credit, on his deathbed, the last time he sees Jen, he tells her he loves her. I don't know if you remember that, but
I might have missed that.
So there's this possible point. Yeah, there's this point where she's in his room and she's begging him not to do it. And he tells her, I love you. And he also tells her, if you tell me not to do it, I won't go.
Oh, I forgot he said that too. Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And so it was the very last possible moment. So in the spirit of the argument, you are correct. He wasted his life, never taking his shot. And that hurts real bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he has a lot to make up for, I feel. And I think that is probably the difference maker. Meaning me trying to put myself in his shoes, I don't think I can. Like John said, I love my life. You know, I'm so blessed and lucky and fortunate. And I just can't even imagine, you know, giving it up.
Yeah. Well, I will say, as far as predictions, I don't think Will's story is done. I don't think he just floats off into space and that he's a forgotten chapter after that. I think there's more to come there.
Yeah, agreed. That'd be a major letdown if it was.
Major. Yeah. But I think there's some spoiler out there I do not want to see. Because it's such a beautiful, intriguing concept. We're going to all read the book, I'm sure. But season two, Netflix, please. Pretty please, soon.
Right. Yeah, seems.
Yeah, because, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of torn. Do I want to? I almost want to just finish the show and then read the books.
Yeah.
I don't think I can wait. I agree. I would like to finish the show and then read the books. I just don't know if I can.
Yeah, because three books, right? It's a trilogy, I believe.
Yes,
it is, yeah.
And so, you know, easily 4-5 years worth of, like, filming and development stuff before it's all out there. I don't even know if it's been greenlit or whatever yet to do
season two. Like, season two is greenlit, as my understanding.
Yeah, cool, awesome.
But your point is probably right. 5 years to get the culmination of all the seasons, all the things, and that's going to be a heck of a wait. I don't know if I can. My skin would crawl if I don't. Some of these things. It's such a compelling thing. One last shout. I will make one prediction on the wheel going off into Never Never Land, and it's totally off the wall, meaning I don't really think this is realistic, but this is kind of the only thing I'm grasping at straws. If I got to predict, there's this concept of the Holtzman brain, and it's like a brain floating in space, and I'm not a big fan of it, by the way, but it's an interesting concept of things popping into the universe, like quantum particles and things just popping up out of the vacuum of space, and the least complicated thing that would create intelligence would be a brain itself. So creating an entire body would be very difficult to pop into quantum, you know, out of a quantum foam, but the brain is a little bit easier, still difficult, but a little bit easier. And so this guy Holtzman, he had this concept of consciousness is this Holtzman brain, this brain that pops into existence and is just conscious. It's not evolved, it's not created, it just pops in as a quantum function, but it's just a brain. And it's very interesting in that regard, in that they're shipping this guy's brain.
Right. Into Wouldn't space. That be interesting? Wouldn't that be interesting if that does pop in to the storyline?
Yeah, I'm not super familiar. Please, you know, wiki this thing and read up on it. It's never really tickled me for whatever reason, but it is a concept out there of a brain floating in space, which is right on the money for this thing.
Hmm. Nice. Awesome. Well, yeah, that's a great place to wrap up. So, awesome work, you guys, detailing out some of these problems. So this will be fun to pivot into solutions next week. So it's been so enjoyable, as always. Thank you, guys. If you're listening, feel free to leave us a review or contact us, sendingpoets@gmail.com. Until next week, keep in mind John Adams' quote, you will never be alone with a poet in your pocket.